Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And the reason this episode is so special is this is our 100th episode. And to commemorate that, we have actually brought on the great Earl Hirsch. And we are going to talk all about the 25-year anniversary of continuous glucose monitoring. So, Earl, do you mind introducing yourself for, and just in case there's anyone that doesn't already know you?
Huh. I think there's a lot of people who don't know me, but I appreciate the opportunity to talk. My name is Earl Hirsch. I'm at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm a professor of medicine here. And I am about to celebrate my 35th year here at the university.
Wow, that's incredible. So I would love to start diving into this. You know, it's funny because our producer actually said to us one day recently, you know, it's the 25th anniversary of CGM. And it took me back because we've stopped counting, haven't we? Because so many things are changing so quickly. Even in this past year, we've gotten, you know, approval for two over the counter. We get this, we have 14 days, it's 15 days. We have 7 days, it's now 10 days. We've seen all these changes. We've seen Medicare improve. And then I stop and think, wow, 25 years ago, what did that look like? So take us back that 25 years and tell us about the first CGMs that you used and your experience then. And let's just start this adventure.
Well, it was actually a little more than 25 years. It was late January, or more likely early February of 1999, when I saw my first CGM. I was at the ADA post-grad course. And in those days, in that particular year, we were in Honolulu.
Oh, man. West, they do that anymore.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore. And I don't know why they don't do that, but that's where I was. And I was in this room and presenting the first MiniMed. It wasn't Medtronic in those days. It was a MiniMed. Today, we would call it a professional or blinded CGM. It was called SpeedGMS. And the person who presented it to us was none other than Mr. Al Mann.
Wow.
And Al showed us this device, and he said, and I will never forget this as long as I live, he says, this is going to change your world, and it's going to change the world of everybody in this room.
He was right.
He was right. He was right. We were able to get this before it became commercially available, and I remember this so well because in those days, it was a 3-day professional CGM. So we would put it on the patient. The patient would wear it for 3 days. And I'm pretty sure, I don't remember all the details. I'm pretty sure they had to calibrate it for that first one. And Thanksgiving came and left. And I remember the patient. I remember him very well. And not only do I remember him, I saw him about a week ago. So he's still with us. He's in his 80s. And he was my first patient to use this. And the reason why I remember it so well is he was wearing this blinded CGM. It was Black Friday in Seattle, 1999. And he was, not only was he hypoglycemic, but he was hypoglycemic while driving on Mercer Island on his way into Seattle. And the good news was he was driving the right way and he wasn't going where everybody, he wasn't going where everyone was coming at him, but he was driving in circles. He didn't know where he was going. And we had it all documented. And that's when I became a believer right then. You know, I'm pretty sure that was the first documented hypoglycemia when driving and when driving in circles, not knowing where you were going. And I don't think I kept that tracing, but I will never, ever forget that as we entered into Y2K. That was Thanksgiving 25 years ago. Now, the gentleman does suffer from hypoglycemia unawareness to this day, but he's doing great in his 80s simply because of CGM. I want to make one other really important point that doesn't get the credit it deserves. I remember, and I think both of you remember, starting finger stick glucose testing. And we are focused, as we should be, on CGM. But I have to tell you something. If it wasn't going to finger stick glucose testing, we never would have had the DCCT. It saved many, many people's lives, despite the fact that nobody liked to do it. But what I remember the most about that primitive technology, as we think about it today, as we end 2024, is that it was controversial to even do it until 1993, when the DCCT came out. I remember one of my very first patients here in Seattle. I can't remember if it was a type 1 or type 2 patient. It was a patient on insulin that I prescribed a meter and strips. And I tell this story all the time because it was literally the very next day that the patient's family practice physician called me. And I even remember his name. But he called me and he yelled at me for prescribing a meter and strips when it was expensive, it hurt, people weren't going to do it, and it was a waste of time. And that was in 1990. And then in 1997, I went to the state capitol, Olympia, Washington, to testify for the American Diabetes Association that insurance companies should cover finger stick glucose testing, not just for anybody, but for children, because they didn't want to cover it for children because they did not feel it was appropriate and it was too expensive. Now, that was 1997. It wasn't that long ago. And the reason why I bring that up, and the good news is we won, and it forced insurance companies to cover finger stick glucose testing for children and adults. But I want to talk about that just to emphasize how far we've come in such a short period of time.
That, yeah, I mean, that's crazy to hear that was the reception when BGM first became available. So were you kind of seeing the same thing then with CGM? I mean, all the resistance, fortunately, has gotten a lot better, but the resistance about it initially only being for certain people or having to have type 1, has it been kind of a similar type of reception to it?
The reception was a little bit better in our circles that the three of us live in. But with that being said, it wasn't good on the payer circle. So that takes us to 2007 and 2008, where I met Roy Beck, and we were involved in the JDRF CGM study. And it was mostly pediatricians. It wasn't that many investigators, but there were only three of us who did adults. And in the study, the participants were broken up into children, adolescents, young adults, and adults over the age of 26. And we just did the adults in our center, but there were only two other adult sites. One was Howard Wolpert at the Joslin, and the other was Bruce Bode in Atlanta. And not that there was pressure on us, but we were told that if we could show a significant A1C drop, two of the major national insurance companies would start paying for CGM. And of course, on the adult side, we did see that. There's a lot of stories in there that I won't get into now. Maybe when the three of us are having a beer somewhere at a international meeting, I can tell you what actually happened. But the bottom line is we did see a significant drop. And that was really, in my view, the beginning of the era of CGM, because now we started getting coverage because we had this New England Journal of Medicine article that showed in the adults this 0.52% A1C drop. And that was the beginning, and we haven't looked back ever since.
I think that's really interesting because I think the, you know, in the past, we, in very early CGM days, we had, we jokingly said we bought CGM out of the trunks of cars, right? Because you literally would talk to the company and give them your credit card number and they would charge your credit card and send you one, right? Early GlucoWatch Biographer, early Navigators, those weren't covered by insurance. You paid for them. And, you know, and people, early adopters said, no, I want this. I don't care what anyone says. I want this. Now, we as prescribers still had to prescribe them. But you're right. This, it does change because we saw things we never saw before, right? I think that's interesting, though, that that's where, you know, and that's where we actually started seeing, but that's not that long ago to start say to an insurance company, hey, look, we're actually reducing A1C. And that's really before a whole lot of hypoglycemia data. Can you talk? So we got insurances to say yes. When did you start really seeing like, wow, hypoglycemia, right? Like let's overnight NPH, those kinds of things.
It was really the study. So in the study, we use the Freestyle Navigator. This is the JDRF CGM study. We used the Freestyle Navigator. We used one of the early Dexcom's STS. I can't remember the exact which one we used. And we also used the Medtronic sensor. And one of the problems with the study is that the Medtronic was only used with the pump, but most of the patients in that study were on the pump. There were very few MDI patients. And so when the insurance company started saying, okay, we will cover this, but we are only going to cover it for patients who are on pumps. And in the big world of T1D in those days, there weren't many people on pumps. And so that very much limited what we were able to do at first. But, you know, over time, it became very clear around the world as more RCTs were done. And there was much more enthusiasm. And we could see for our own eyes how we minimized hypoglycemia with the sensors. And that was the big thing. I think as I look back in history, the two biggest things off the top of my head that really brought CGM into standard of care was the JDRF study that I mentioned. But the other one was, and I have to give my colleague Ann Peters the greatest credit for this, but it was fast forward to the end of 2017 when we were able to get Medicare to approve CGM. And the reason why I say that is that that is the population in the type 1 population that needs it the most. Yet we had the hardest time getting it for them. But we did get it. And a huge shout out to Ann. She was passionate about this and she wasn't going to let anybody tell her no. And that is one of the main reasons today, as we end 2024 and enter 2025, we have so many seniors with type 1 diabetes. I can't remember the last time I saw a death from type 1 diabetes. They still happen, but I haven't seen one, whereas I used to see it not uncommonly. In fact, if you look at hypoglycemia and DKA together, the two of them together in the three modern day studies looking at etiology of mortality in type 1 diabetes, it's acute diabetes emergencies, DKA and hypoglycemia. That's number three, only behind cardiovascular disease and malignancy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Medicare coverage has been amazing, and especially how we've seen it go from needing to be on 4 injections a day and 4 finger sticks a day to now anyone on insulin can access it that has Medicare or even that has severe hypoglycemia. Can you talk a little bit about, I feel like when CGM got rid of the need for calibrations, That was a huge deal. And I think that really came with Libre. Then we saw that with Dexcom G6. But can you talk a little bit about how that experience was?
So it was big factory calibration. A lot of people didn't think we would ever see it. And of course, history proved those people wrong. I think that we have to acknowledge that even without the calibration, and even with the calibration for the very early sensors, the accuracy of these sensors were not very good by today's standards. They've gotten better. They will continue to get better. But this was a huge problem. And it remains a problem for a lot of these senior patients who, I think to their credit, they don't trust anything or anybody. And before they give insulin, they're still going to do a finger stick. And frankly, that's what we do in the hospital anyway, because we don't have a CGM approval in the hospital. And that's a whole other interesting discussion, talking about AID in the hospital and what we did with pumps in the hospital, and how different doctors think about CGM in the hospital. That's worthy of an entire other discussion. But your point, Diane, is really important, because in those early sensors, the factory calibration was really a game changer for so many people. And now you fast forward to today, if you have a sensor that needs calibration, you're not going to make it in the market. And there are sensors that, you know, when I was at EASD in September, there were all these companies I had never heard of, but some of them, they still needed calibration. And I don't think any of them are ever going to be competitive. And there were many of them. So the calibration is a big deal. But I think as we're moving forward, and not only do we not have calibration, but we now have over-the-counter sensors. And those are going to continue to proliferate over time. And my big concern in general is that people don't understand that these sensors are not going to always be spot on with the finger stick. And there are so many reasons for that, including the fact that the finger stick is measuring something different than the interstitial fluid in the sensor, on top of the fact that there's a biologic variation. And the reality is the finger stick is not the gold standard anyway. The gold standard is the laboratory hexokinase method. But patients don't understand why the numbers aren't spot on. And I mention this because as we are just now getting into the over-the-counter era of CGM, I fear there will be a lot of people without diabetes who are using this, who are going to be calling their doctor, calling the companies, very concerned about all of the hypoglycemia they see, not realizing you can get hypoglycemia if you are lying on it overnight, or that first day the accuracy is not very good, especially those first 12 hours. I mean, our patients now are used to this, but I just worry as we open this up to everybody, it's going to create a lot of confusion.
I agree. I think that we haven't gotten a whole lot of data back. You know, they're just now being sold this fall, right? So we haven't gotten a whole lot of people referred in yet that have decided either that they have an insulinoma or that they, you know, I mean, you know, that, okay, these are hypoglycemic. And then, of course, they develop the feelings around it because they must be feeling this. And, you know, here we are, and you're really not any of those things, right? But I also wonder, I think we're going to also see the positive side of that, which is there's going to be someone who puts it on or who puts it on their mom because they, you know, whatever. And we see these postprandial spikes and say, wow, you have prediabetes or early type 2 diabetes or whatever we see, and maybe get to treat them earlier, right? And I think that's going to be, we're going to see a mixture of both.
And sometimes it's not so early. So I have
exactly.
I have two people in the last 6 months who their A1C says pre-diabetes. One person had kettle corn, spiked up to 300. The other person had a bagel, spiked up to 280. They have diabetes.
That's not pre-anything, right? Exactly.
Yeah. And the sensor is going to be able to help us quite a bit with that. But with the understanding, you can't use a sensor glucose to make a diagnosis of diabetes. And by the same token, the A1C is so fraught with problems. Making the diagnosis of diabetes from an A1C, or pre-diabetes for that matter. In some patients, you're going to over-diagnose it. In some patients, you're going to under-diagnose it.
Right. I think that is, you know, that whole discussion, even in an office, when we're seeing someone looking at a CGM download, right? And we say, well, your estimated A1C based on your CGM download is this, but your A1C came back at this. And you start talking about the variability of the two and the life of the red blood cells and, you know, all the sometimes we can even find a hemoglobinopathy in these people because we haven't, because we don't know, right? I think that there's a lot of discussion around, you know, just like the inaccuracies of finger sticks when someone doesn't wash their hands with, we call it real soap and real water, right? I say, when you calibrate, I need real soap and real water on your real hands, right? None of this, maybe I've washed them, I washed them on Tuesday, right? I think it's the same thing with A1C, right? A1C is accurate, very accurate in some people, right, as an average glucose, but very inaccurate in a big group of other people. So I think that it all, I think as a person, I want a number. I want to fix this. I want to know where I am. And with all of these measures, with finger sticks, with CGM, and with A1C, there's a little bit of a dance in the background.
Right. And what clinicians need to appreciate is the older your population, the more discordance you're going to have, because all these comorbidities have so much impact both on the red blood cell survival time, perhaps glycation rates in general. But, you know, you get somebody with kidney disease, liver disease, leukemia, any kind of anemia at all. And there's drugs. There are many drugs that impact A1C. So I really... you know, one of the things, getting back to CGM, maybe one of the most important things we didn't think about, the impact of CGM, is the discordance of the GMI with the A1C. And the fact that we've been using this for years to tell somebody they've been under good control or not, or the fact we've been using this for years to tell a woman it's safe for her to get pregnant. We were wrong, because the A1C doesn't tell us that in many people.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that is concerning. So along those lines, I mean, do you think we should be utilizing GMI now, or should we just be focused on the percentage time in range?
Yeah. So this gets a little bit away from CGM, but I have some very strong opinions about this. I think you and I have talked before about the glycemic ratio, and that is the GMI over the A1C. And we have a paper that is going to be submitted hopefully this week. We have, but it's essentially the data that we've presented over the last couple of years. We've just added to it, showing that you can look at somebody's ability to glycate proteins by looking at the ratio of the GMI over the A1C. So if the A1C is running high, if it's running more than 10% higher and the A1C is on the denominator, that means you're doing more glycation, not just of hemoglobin, but the retina and the glomerulus and the kidney. So if you have a GMI less than 0.9, and we presented this at the ATTD, not this year in Florence, but last year. Where were we last year? Because you entered Berlin.
Yeah.
We were in Berlin. And what was showed is that if that GMI is less, the GMI over the A1C is less than 0.9, the risk of retinopathy was 2.2-fold higher and the risk of kidney disease was 2.8-fold higher. So I don't believe that the A1C is better than the GMI or vice versa. I think we need to use them together to look at how well or how not well somebody is glycating. So if you look at this the other direction, if the A1C is running lower than the GMI, what our data suggests with about 650 people, our data suggests you're protected from those complications at any given glucose.
That's fascinating. I can't wait to see that paper.
Yeah. So one more question about that, though. When you're looking at the GMI over A1C, are you doing the GMI based on the last 2 weeks? Or are you using a GMI? Like, did you standardize based on a 30-day or 90-day? How did you decide?
Well, we did what we could.
Right. Of course. Right. Yeah. Because it's. Yeah.
And so when we, it all had to do with how we did the GMIs in our clinic when this was all happening. What Roy Beck and Rich Bergenstahl showed was you only need 14 days.
Okay.
Now, if you're on vacation, you're sick, you're in the hospital. I mean, but as a rule of thumb, you don't get any benefit after 3 weeks compared to 2 weeks. But you do get benefit after 2 weeks after 10 days. With all of that being said, our data for our GMI averaged 25 days.
25 days. Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for that little detour. Going back to like specific CGM, I'm curious kind of your thoughts on now we have an implantable CGM, 365 days. It's evolved to from the original 90 days and then 180 days. Kind of your thoughts on that and how it may continue to shake up the market. And then kind of also what we can expect in the future as well.
Yeah. So we haven't had a lot of uptake in Seattle for the implantable CGM. I think there are several reasons for that. The main one being reimbursement. If I look, because they, you know, Senseonix is not a new company, but we've always had problems with reimbursement for everything. It's not just that. So that's been an issue. With that being said, there continues to be improvements with all of the CGMs. And what I really believe is going to happen over the next 3 to 5 years is there will be options for patients to use non-invasive sensors. There are many skeptics about that, which is good because we haven't had a non-invasive sensor up until now. There's a company in Seattle, which I am not involved with. They're called KNOW, No Labs.
Yes.
They presented data and they actually published a paper earlier this year with their first generation prototype. They had an MARD of 14%. I work with a company in Israel called Hagar, and we published data. Our data only went up to 180 milligrams per deciliter at the time. It can now do the full physiologic range. That had an MARD of 6.8%, but it looked very good in the low ranges. Since the company is Israeli, things have slowed down quite a bit because of the conflict in the Middle East right now. But I think the much bigger point is there are 6 or 8 companies working on this right now. And let's not forget, Apple has been working on this for a long time. So has Samsung, other technology companies. And I believe we're going to see this. Now, here's the part that is going to be tougher that I don't know. When we get these sensors out, whoever it is, and maybe there's one, maybe there's five, are they going to be like the atrial fibrillation app on your watch, on your Apple Watch, where you have this app on your watch that can tell you if you're in AFib, but it never actually went to the FDA. And it's a consumer device. And theoretically, we could see the same with glucose, in that you go to Apple or you go onto Amazon and you get, who knows, maybe it's Sony, maybe it's Microsoft, who knows, but you get an app for your watch. It never goes through the FDA, so you could never use it to give insulin, let alone AID. Even if the accuracy and the consensus air grids are better than what we have, if it doesn't go to FDA, well, then you can't use it for insulin. It's used for health. And my guess, realistically, is that we will have both. We will have those that are used for health and those that are used for diabetes. But going through the FDA is a much bigger deal and much more difficult, especially if we're dealing with a company that has never done that, nor do they want to do that. They don't. It's not part of their business plan. Their business plan is to get as many of them out there as possible.
One more question on CGM, because I know we got to let you go. But we've heard a lot of talk about not just CGM, but also monitoring other substances like ketones, for example. What do you see with that happening? Do you think it's going to be all CGMs will eventually all be monitoring ketones? Or do you think it's kind of hype at this point and we're going to stick to glucose?
No, we're going to see ketones. That's a given. Now, whether all the sensors measure ketones or not, I doubt it, but we may see more than one company with ketones. But I think it gets even more interesting when you look at now I'm really looking out a little further, but when you look at the non-invasive space, the fact is it's not just in the interstitial fluid you can look at these different molecules, but in the interstitial space, you can look at beta-hydroxybutyrate, you can look at creatinine, you can look at lactate, you can look at beta-HCG. You can tell non-invasively if a woman is pregnant. And you remember those days when Star Trek, when Spock would go over your head and tell you everything wrong. Well, we could have a sensor that does all of that, including to say, don't take that lady to X-ray, even though she's unconscious. She's got alcoholic ketoacidosis and she's pregnant. Her beta-HCG is high.
Wow. Right. Wow. I mean, we're really excited. We had a concrete, Diane and I were at We spoke at a meeting last week and, you know, talked about this continuous ketone monitoring because we think it's coming sooner than later, right? As opposed to some of the other measurements. And, you know, we are when we look at people with type 2 or type 1 diabetes and using SGLT2 inhibitors and that risk of euglycemic DKA, and, you know, like if we had a continuous ketone monitor, I would pretty much put anyone with proteinuria on an SGLT2 inhibitor, right? And that risk, though, because you can't always pick, like you think in the beginning, we thought, okay, it's for thin people that don't take a lot of insulin. And then we ended up with DKA with some, you know, people with larger body habitus than you would picture and ended up with euglycemic DKA anyway. And where is that risk profile and how do you do all that? I'm pretty excited about the continuous ketone monitoring.
Yeah, the only thing I would say in my final comment about the continuous ketone monitors, what we will learn the most, which we don't have as good of an understanding now as we need to have, is how the different AID systems, what is the ketone trends when you're on an AID system with frequent insulin interruptions? And the algorithms are all different, and the amount of time you have insulin interruptions are different depending on which system you're using. And I think we are going to learn so much about what are the safer and the not safer AIDs to use if you're also going to use an SGLT2 inhibitor at the same time.
I love it. Definitely. Well, one more thing. You're on your way to Asia for the first international technology meeting. We're so excited for you. We would, if we were your friend, be jealous, but you're not jealous. You're excited for these, right? We're so excited.
I appreciate that, yeah.
What's the biggest thing you're looking forward to?
It's not the 17-hour flight from Seattle. I'll tell you that.
Right.
You know, I am actually sincerely looking forward to a lot of regional physicians who have never been to ATTD, who want to learn more about technology, who really have not had the opportunity to participate. Where I live now, I'm in the corner of the United States, but we are sort of the gateway for Asia here. Delta Airlines, for example, this is their hub to Asia. And we see a lot of patients coming over from Asia. We hosted many physicians over the years wanting to learn. And it's going to a part of the world that has not been as fortunate as we have. And being able to teach them and work with them and show them is really an honor.
Well, that is awesome. And then they just, yeah, thanks for all that you're doing. And with that, we thank you so much, Dr. Hirsch, for joining us today. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. We hope that you will join us again next time. Thank you.